We are going to have probably a rather swift passage through a number of passages tonight that are going to be a bit more challenging, perhaps, or a different sort of a presentation than we normally do. That's because there has been for about, since the 70s, I guess now, so it's been a little while, but since then, with an increasingly greater difficulty, the churches in this country and abroad have been threatened, have been assailed by a new-ish doctrine since the 70s now. It's not so new, I guess. But a doctrine that it was really unusual that had gained a foothold among us. And so on last Sunday's morning class, I mentioned that from the reading in John chapter 5. A moment ago, Dick very capably read John chapter 5. For the sake of time tonight, I'm not going to read it again, but just remember, in that passage, and you might turn over there if you like while I'm just giving this introduction, I won't read it, but that passage just mentions two resurrections. What has cropped up among us and in the denominational world as well in recent years has been the idea from a group that calls itself Realized Eschatologists that there are not two resurrections that are mentioned in that passage, that there's only one, and that this one resurrection that's being talked about in that passage has nothing to do with bodies coming out of tombs. Now, unhappily, this idea, as I say, has gained quite a foothold among us, and so periodically I feel the need, and I think now tying in with John 5 from last week, we studied it in the morning class, be a good opportunity for us to spend a little bit of time tonight and talk about this, because as you remember John chapter 5, verses 25 through 29, they are claiming that there's not only no bodily resurrection being talked about there, but that there's no bodily resurrection to be found anywhere in the Old Testament. They want us to believe that the Bible does not hold out the hope of a resurrection, that no human form, once it has died, will ever come out of the tombs. And what they're trying to do is to foist off upon us and the world at large the idea that resurrection has been misunderstood as referring to physical bodies and should have been understood as referring to the renewal of a covenant. Now, at this point, I would like to ask you to turn over to Acts chapter 24, because Acts chapter 24 is one of the sort of flagship passages for these people and for this doctrine. So let's start there. I missed the one there. It should be Acts 24, verses 10 through 15. I've got 10 through 5, so we'd be backing up, I guess. But we have in this passage, in chapter 24, Paul appearing before a governor by the name of Felix. In verse 10, Acts 24, when the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded and he said, "Knowing that for many years you've been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense, since you can note, you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. And neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find," turn the page, yes, "city itself, did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing," and here's where it gets critically important, "believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked." Well, of course, John 5, 28 and 29 refers to a resurrection of the righteous and the wicked. The question is whether or not we're talking about bodies coming out of graves. Now, one of the great important arguments to them that you're going to hear a lot if you meet any of these people is that here in this passage, there cannot be found anybody in Israel hoping for a physical bodily resurrection in the Old Testament. So, if you can't find it in the Old Testament, then you can't teach it in the New either. they rather boldly, I've always thought, say here that when Paul in chapter 24 in verse 15 says that he has a hope which these men cherish themselves, that his hope and their hope, the ones that were charging him of being a false teacher, would have seen him killed if they could, these Jews had the same hope that Paul had. Well, wouldn't they, these people argue, have wanted a bodily resurrection then? And so they're arguing, no, they didn't, because of verse 14, that Paul believes everything that's in accordance with the law that's written in the prophets. So they deny the prophets ever speak of a bodily resurrection. They'll challenge you to go find anybody in the Old Testament that ever wanted to have a bodily resurrection. And if Paul and the Pharisees here agree on a future resurrection, and you can't read it in the Old Testament, they claim, then none of them were thinking in terms of a bodily resurrection. They want us to believe that all resurrection passages are dealing with the coming of a new covenant, the resurrection, if you will, figuratively from the dead, of God's covenant, but not bodies coming out of tombs. So, what we're going to do tonight first is just reference, and you can jot these down. I haven't got the time to go look at each one of these, but I first just want to point out that physical resurrection itself is not unknown in the Old Testament. In 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 21 and 22, the widow's son in those verses is raised from the dead. The widow's son is not a covenant. The widow did not want a covenant. She wanted her son back. And so there is physical resurrection being manifested, miraculously taking place in the Old Testament, and you'll know full well in the New Testament as well. And tonight I'm going to limit myself entirely to the Old Testament. We're not going to be looking at the New Testament passages on resurrection, just the Old. But take note, 1 Kings 17, 21 and 22. And in 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 32 through 37, the Shunammite's son is also raised from the dead some years later. And again in 2 Kings chapter 13, verses 20 and 21, an unknown man who is hurriedly, because of a threat of problem, tossed into Elisha's tomb, when he comes into contact with Elisha's bones, is raised from the dead. So let me first just say, brethren, that resurrections that take place in the Old Testament are physical. And one just might get the idea that you could come back from the dead physically by reading the Old Testament. These passages, of course, they'll poo-poo and suggest, nobody would get the idea that they were raised from the dead. These are just oddities, I guess. But I'm suggesting to you, brother, that when you see this taking place in the Old Testament, the Old Testament people of the time and the Old Testament readers for all time just might get to thinking along the lines that perhaps coming back from the dead would be a good thing, don't you think? And they would be pretty impressed that God has the power to do that. That's not an argument, it's just an observation. Physical resurrection is found in the Old Testament. What the argumentation is going to be is the following passages. I think there's eight of them, if I remember correctly. So again, jot these down. I'm hoping you will, particularly maybe in some page at the back of your Bible, let's say, because unhappily, you're rather likely to bump into some of these people. They are very militant. And in my personal experience, they're also quite subversive. I have yet to find one that really comes in and declares himself. But they just love to start working through email and phone calls and personally among you in churches of Christ, consciously, purposely. I can tell you quite a few stories and kind of curl your hair about how they circumvent the elders' authority, how they will go around elders and preachers, avoiding them. I've had a lot of very unhappy personal experiences of what I believe can be referred to as nothing short of just subterfuge. By the time the elders find out that this doctrine has taken root among the saints, it's too late. It's taken root.
And to my knowledge, we have absolutely no problem with it here. That's why I'm preaching, you know, this sermon. I bring it up every so often, not often, but every so often, because I see this as a very real threat. So what I'm going to do this evening is I'm going to give you a list of passages in which Old Testament people understood and hoped for a physical resurrection. And that the hope of Israel that Paul mentions, not just in chapter 24 of the book of Acts, but also in chapter 28, for instance, that hope was for a physical resurrection, like they'd read about took place at least three times in their Old Testament, in which I believe, brethren, is the passionate desire of every human being who has ever lived and come face to face with death. This is the natural thing that everybody wants. So you really are swimming upstream if you're going to try to undo people's faith and confidence in a future judgment of both the righteous and the wicked, a physical resurrection of bodies out of tombs, out of graves, coming up out of cemeteries. You know what? You've got your work cut out for you. What surprises me is that they've been succeeding at it. So let's take up the challenge. Is it true that the hope of Israel that Paul references and for which he's in chains had nothing to do with anybody ever hoping to come out of a grave, but it had everything to do only with a covenant? Let's turn back to the book of Job. The 14th chapter of the book of Job, we'll be looking at verses 7 through 15. Chapter 14 of the book of Job, of course, we're well into his argumentation that he is being punished not because he's a sinner, he's innocent of sin, but for unknown reasons. He doesn't understand it at all. His friends are accusing him, but he's suffering horribly. And the whole book is about suffering despite the fact that you are not being punished by God for sin, and how to grapple and wrestle with such a problem. Now, in Job chapter 14, with that setting, look at verse 7. There's hope for a tree when it is cut down, that it will sprout again, and its shoots will not fail. Though its roots grow old in the ground and its stump dies in the dry soil, at the scent of water it will flourish and put forth sprigs like a plant. But man dies and lies prostrate. Man expires, and where is he? Now, pardon me. It's allergy season. Verse 11. As water evaporates from the sea and a river becomes parched and dried up, so man lies down and does not rise. Now, brother, up to this point, you might be thinking, well, that's their argument. They're trying to maintain that man will never rise. And so far, and compared to these trees and stumps, kind of sounds that way, doesn't it? But wait a minute in verse 12. So a man lies down and does not rise. Wait a minute. What was the comparison to? You know, trees and stumps. And do they not sometimes come back again? Sure they do. How many of you have seen a tree cut off, you know, 8 inches off the ground, and what do you see shortly later? It's just tree growing everywhere out of that thing, isn't there? See? But do people do that? No. Maybe I'm glad. Weird thing to even think about. So his point was, in comparison to the tree, men don't do that. But look at 12. So a man lies down and does not rise until the heavens be no more. He will not awake nor be roused out of his sleep. No, he will not be roused out of that sleep of death. But there's a caveat there. Until what? Till the heavens are no more. 13. Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, realm of the dead, that you would conceal me until your wrath returns to you, that you would set a limit for me and remember me. If a man dies, will he live again? And Job was full of these thoughts. He just thought, in the condition he was in, he may well die. All the days of my struggle I will wait until what comes, brethren, in verse 14? Until my change comes.
Verse 15, you will call, and I will answer you. You will long for the work of your hands. Now, what did Job actually say right there?
He said, we're not like trees. We don't sprout back like stumps. That's not true. And as long as the heavens exist, we're not coming back out of the grave. But as soon as he said that, what does that plant in your mind? What happens when the heavens no longer exist? And what does he tell you? God will call. And you will what? You're going to respond. You're coming back out of that grave. What was Job's hope? He didn't want to be a tree, but he still wanted to come back physically. And he declared in that 14th chapter that when God calls him, he will. Now, let's turn just a few more pages, and you'll see one that's even more dramatic and plain than this. So I just went to 14 because it came first. But look at Job 19 now. I've been challenged time and again by these people. Why? There's no Old Testament hope for resurrection, you know, at all. Well, wait a minute. Let's look at Job 19 and start at verse 25 and read to the end of that chapter. As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives. That sound familiar to anybody? I know. You can do the rest of that song by heart. As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last, he will take his stand where? On the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how shall we persecute him? What pretext for a case against him can we find? Then be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment.
Job's pretty justifiably upset about the way his friends are treating him. And he right well may die, but he is free from sin. They are unjustly accusing him. So that chapter concludes with his warning them about such a thing. But before we ever got there,
what was Job's expectation and Job's hope that would happen to him in the flesh so that his eyes would be working again after his skin was destroyed? What do we call that? Resurrection. Bodies coming back out of tombs.
Is it at all true that no Old Testament figure ever looked ahead to a future resurrection of the flesh? Could Paul not say that he had the hope of Israel maybe aborning right here in Job? Well, of course he could. That hope is not the renewal of a covenant. It is that day when even after your flesh has been destroyed, it will be restored. And after your eyes have rotted out of their sockets and you've been long dead, and for Job it's been 4,000 years now, still yet he will in the flesh and with those eyes see the Lord. What does that require? Brethren, it requires resurrection. That's the hope of Job, and it's the hope of Israel. Let's come on over to Psalm number 16. The 16th Psalm will, of course, be quite familiar to students such as yourself, who have a reputation across the country for being well taught, for being good students, for knowing these things. You're going to recognize that these verses are quoted in Acts chapter 2, but we won't be going over there. In Psalm 16, verses 9 through 11, let's just think here about David and what he wrote. 16:9. Therefore my heart is glad and my glory rejoices. My flesh also will dwell securely, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor will you allow your what to undergo decay. The Holy One, Jesus, you will make known to me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. In your right hand there are pleasures forever. Now, brethren, that is a prophecy about Jesus' resurrection.
How was Jesus raised from the dead? This passage is quoted in Acts chapter 2. Is this a covenant being resurrected? No, and they'll admit that, surprisingly. They've never tried to argue that we've misunderstood Jesus' resurrection. They've never tried to argue that we've misunderstood the New Testament resurrection, the widow named son, for instance. There's at least three times Jesus raised people from the dead. Two of the apostles raised people from the dead. They know that that's physical bodies coming out of tombs. Brothers, this is a prophecy about Jesus' resurrection. Would that not give us hope that maybe because he has escaped death, that we might escape death? Would it be permissible for me to conceive the idea that the Messiah might save me from death and demonstrated it in his own resurrection? Is that off limits? Is that wrong for me to entertain such a thought? Well, of course not, brethren. The very prophecy of the Messiah was of a resurrection from the dead that we might have hope in him for that. Now let's turn to Psalm number 49. Psalm 49 is not written by David. If you'll notice the title there, some anonymous son of Korah, which was a group of psalm writers and singers and musicians back in the Old Testament times. But this group, these sons of Korah, wrote quite a few psalms, as a matter of fact, renowned for some of them. Psalm 49, we're going to be reading verses 12 through 15, which begins like this. Man in his pomp will not endure. He's like the beasts that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish and of those after them who approve their words. As sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. The upright shall rule over them in the morning, and their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Brethren, we will be redeemed from the power of Sheol. What is the power of Sheol? It is death in my body decaying in the ground. Now he's saying that is going to be reversed. That is going to be redeemed. The son of Korah's hope was for this redemption of the flesh. Now let's go to yet another passage in the Psalms, Psalm number 71. In Psalm, the 71st chapter, which is entirely anonymous, though it appears to be the reflections of an older man. We just don't know who this man is. But in Psalm 71, look at the two verses, 19 and 20. Your righteousness, O God, reaches to the heavens. You have done great things. O God, who is like you? You who have shown me many troubles and distresses will revive me again and will bring me up again. From where? From a covenant problem? From not being in a covenant relationship? Who could see that in this passage? It says, you will bring me up again from the depths of the earth. This anonymous psalmist's hope, he's in Israel, by the way, this anonymous psalmist, whose psalm is collected with the others, is sung regularly like all the others, in the temple throughout the years, in the other worship of the Jews, in their homes on numerous occasions. This, another of the great body of songs that Israel treasured and sang, speaks of the hope of Israel, which is what hope? Revived from the depths of the earth. That's resurrection. One might be excused for wanting to come back out of that grave. Let's turn to Isaiah in the 26th chapter of Isaiah's book.
Now, as you know, in our Wednesday night class, we've been in Isaiah now for several weeks. We're going to be there now for several more to come. Now, I've got a sort of a detour this week with the Proverbs, a lot of Proverbs this week. But I've been looking at Isaiah quite a bit. So Isaiah chapter 26 now, verses 19 and 20 and 21 say this. Your dead will live. Their covenant will rise. Good. Hoped I'd see a few raised eyebrows. I even got some whole raised heads. Thanks, Curtis. Does anybody's Bible say covenant? My Bible says corpses will rise. You who lie in the dust, awake and shout for joy. For your dew is as the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits. Brother, what does that mean? It means that when you die, your spirit separates from your body. The body's going to rot in the ground. But one day, what will that spirit do? It's coming back to a resurrected body. Now, by this point, I hope you're realizing that Isaiah's hope, and if ever there was a man that might be described as being of Israel, Isaiah's hope, brethren, was not just that the covenant might come back, it might be better, might be newer, might be, you know, somehow different. He's talking about his flesh coming out of the ground. This is Isaiah's hope as well. We'll close with the last chapter of the book of Daniel. Daniel's very famous prophecy as he runs through chapter 11, prophesying about the historical nations, one after another, after another, after another, passing through massive amounts of time, until finally in Daniel chapter 12, he says this at the very start of the chapter. At that time, Michael, the great prince who stands over the sons of your people, will arise. And there will be a time of distress such as has never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time your people, everyone who's found written in the book, will be rescued. And many of those who sleep where? In the dust of the ground. Now, brethren, look. I'm 64 years old. I've been on a few camping trips. I've been in the army. There's been a few times I had to sleep on the ground. I found it distasteful. They invented inflatable mattresses for this reason. Okay? Nobody sleeps in the dust of the ground, flesh to dirt, you know, on purpose. This is dead people. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. And those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. Those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And I suggest to you that in the prophetic history, what we wind up with there in Daniel chapter 12 is a reference to a future resurrection of bodies from the ground. So we'll close this sermon. Sermon has been nothing more than a long list of scriptures, with one that I'll have you go research yourself. I've got perhaps in capital letters, not clear in parentheses, Isaiah 25, verses 6 through 12. I'm planning to hit Jerry tonight, or sometime soon, on this one. May also be another reference to Isaiah's hope, but I really struggled with it. At best, it's not very clear, but that may be another one. Be that as it may, you've got absolutely clear references from Job, a prophecy of Jesus in the Psalms, the son of Korah, an anonymous psalmist, the prophecy about Jesus' resurrection is David, then Isaiah and Daniel. What hope did these men entertain? What is the hope of Israel? Brethren, it's the exact same hope that everyone has who has ever buried a parent like I have, who has ever buried a child, who has ever buried a mate, who has ever buried anyone that they love. What is your hope? That you might be reunited, that you might see them again, that this seemingly irreversible state
might be reversed. And why does the Old Testament repeatedly give you hope to believe? It will. The prophecy of Jesus, fulfilled or not? Fulfilled. And what is the hope of Christianity? Brethren, I want to have a better relationship with God, and I'm glad we're in a better covenant than the old one. But that is not what these people were talking about. So the next time somebody tries to, you know, come, you know, onto you that why you can't find resurrection in the Old Testament, what are you going to do? I hope that page in your Bible that I just had you write all these verses won't hurt you. And if not, you're going to ask me for a copy of this before you leave. Not letting anybody off the hook. We'll make copies for you. But just know this, brethren. Throughout the Old Testament, throughout the New Testament, in the entire chapter nearly, the 1 Corinthians 15, what is the resurrection? It is bodies coming out of tombs. Who's coming out of those tombs? Both the righteous and the wicked. What will there be? Judgment, separation, and eternal consequences as a result. But that there will be one day the sound of a trumpet, the mighty voice of an archangel, and the call to rise from the dead is as certain as you are sitting in a pew here right now tonight. So, that'll be my last warning for this year probably with regard to realized eschatologists, but I've lost some really close friends I had for many years to this doctrine. So it's gotten personal. Okay? And I really don't like the way they worm around, you know, in a congregation undercover for so long before you find out what they're teaching. If you're tempted by anything these people are teaching, come see me at great length. We'll discuss this. I've been asked by a couple of congregations to hold whole meetings on this, and I've done so. If you find out anybody in this congregation is leaning towards such a thing or suggesting such a thing, go immediately to an elder and tell them about it. And they will rise to their responsibility. What it is, as I understand the New Testament, their absolutely preeminent chief responsibility is to see that doctors like that get met with an answer. So, strange night tonight. You're the best people. Every once in a while I have to abuse you with a real technical kind of a lesson. That's a good one, I hope. So, if you have a need, though, that we have not addressed this evening, and to respond to the gospel in order to become a Christian, you have an issue you'd like prayer or Bible study about, by all means, let me know and come speak with me, please, now, as Ted leads us in our final song.